Welcome to Oncology Data Advisor, where we explore the latest advances in cancer research and patient care. Thanks for listening to this episode. Be sure to visit oncdata.com for more content, including expert perspectives from leading oncology thought leaders, FDA approvals, patient advocacy, and much more. And don't forget to subscribe to Oncology Data Advisor on social media to stay up to date on the latest videos, podcasts, and more.
It's Kidney Cancer Awareness Month. I thought this would be a great opportunity to discuss the overlap with kidney cancer and genetics. So Danica, thanks so much for doing this episode with us, just to learn a little bit about what you do, talking about hereditary renal cancer syndrome. So just kind of to start us off, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself, how you got into genetic counseling, and then also how you kind of got into the kidney cancer space?
Yeah, definitely. So when I initially wanted to go into genetics, it's because my brother has cystic fibrosis, which has nothing to do with kidney cancer. But I think when I was young, my parents really would have benefited from having somebody who could guide them in understanding cystic fibrosis and just genetics, understanding what the impact was on our family and just what the implications would be. And so we had the opportunity to work with so many special experts that understood cystic fibrosis, but just didn't have anybody to guide and educate them. So during my training, I had the opportunity to attend Ohio State University, which has a very robust cancer program, and then was also at Yale for a cancer fellowship. And those two experiences gave me insight to how a genetic counselor could really help patients navigate an inherited cancer syndrome. And then gain from the genetic testing, both for themselves, if they were currently affected, but as well as for their families, and then just provide that guidance. And so I think in my role now, I just hope that patients can feel like they can reach out to their genetic counselor at any point and receive guidance or support. Here at MD Anderson, I've had a chance to work through some of the different clinics and have landed here in the GU clinic, and I've just really enjoyed the clinic itself as well as the patient population. So I'm really thankful for that.
Yeah. I think it's really nice to hear there's so many different journeys on how you end up being a genetic counselor. And I kind of like how you talked about, you know, one of the great things about what we do is we can kind of be that like grounding person as they're like navigating these different like specialty providers. So I love kind of how your personal experience and your training really got you to kind of be that person for other patients as well.
Yeah, thanks.
So, you know, there's so many different specialty centers that we get to be a part of. What do you usually think about as far as patients that you like to make sure are getting referred for kidney cancer syndromes or hereditary kidney cancer syndromes?
Yeah, so the key recommendations I would say are based on a personal history. So if someone's diagnosed younger, usually 47 is the age that we recommend. If they have a multifocal or bilateral lesions in their kidneys, or with somebody who has histologies that are associated with hereditary kidney cancer. And so typically papillary type 1 or 2 or chromophobe or oncocytic tumors. And then sometimes pathology can also be an indicator. So sometimes we found that there's a loss of FH and that warrants further assessment. That's all personal history. And then of course, if anybody is affected with kidney cancer and has a family history of any kidney cancer, that would also be a good recommendation to meet with genetics and look into that further.
Yeah. And do you feel like there's kind of a degree of relationship as far as, you know, how close or how far out you'll usually want to think about having patients referred based on family history or thinking about testing based on family history?
Yeah, so with testing, usually we look at like first or second degree. We don't always say that specifically because I think that trips some people up in terms of if they should refer or who's a third degree relative or is this second cousin or first cousin once removed. Mm-hmm. So I think if there's a close family history that the patient themselves is reporting, we say bring them to us and then we can decide, you know, does that appear to be suggestive of testing or not?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's hard for everyone. Have to know exactly
how. Yeah, I think that's kind of the like most ubiquitous thing with genetic counseling is that patients don't always know everything about their family, so we try to make it as easy as possible for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I know kind of in the menu of conditions that you're usually thinking about in the back of your mind is kind of the VHLs, the Burkholm-Dubé's, HLRCC, hereditary papillary renal cell carcinoma. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about these different conditions, what kind of distinguishes one from the others, and then just kind of some features that you usually will keep in the back of your mind as either you're looking at a family history or maybe some features that you would like providers to think about as they're getting some intake information from patients about their family?
Yeah, that's a great question, because a lot of the syndromes have either various different features or have a really long list of features. So I think in that way, it can be hard for people to think about, is it worth sending for genetics or not? When we meet with patients, usually if it's indicative of one particular syndrome, that's kind of what we focus on with educating them. But if they're coming in just because they've got an earlier onset kidney cancer, then we might be talking more about, these are the things that we're looking for, here's possible implications, and then maybe use examples of a couple of the syndromes to further explain, you know, how they might impact the patient. So at the top of the list, of course, is von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, and that's a renal syndrome that affects many areas of the body and causes a higher risk for cancers and tumors. Most of these are benign, so some patients may come in not thinking to share that because it's not a cancer history when they come to MD Anderson. So we want to make sure to pull any of that information out. If they've got any benign tumors, usually we're thinking of like hemangioblastomas, pheochromocytomas, paragangliomas, and then there's also a risk for cancers like, of course, clear cell renal cell carcinoma is the one that comes to mind when we're thinking about kidney cancer. Typically, people when they come in, they have multiple of these features because they can be affected with multiple features starting as early as age 20. So they might already have like the hemangioblastomas or other features that we're thinking about, which would then guide us into looking at VHL more in depth. Next would be Bird-Hogg-Dubay, which is consistent with lung lesions as well as skin lesions, and then renal tumors. Typically, the renal tumors are different, so they're not the most common, which is clear cell. We typically see chromophobe or hybrid oncocytic tumors as well as oncocytomas. And then the skin lesions are typically fibrofolliculomas or trichodiscomas. And these also might not get they might not also get brought to our attention from patients because they might not affect them very much. They're usually small, kind of skin colored little bumps that usually are on the face or the neck or the abdomen. So they tend to not be disruptive, especially initially. They might grow in size and number over time and be more painful, but it's not something that a lot of patients without being asked will share when they're being evaluated for like a cancer syndrome. So that's something really important that we want to make sure to assess or see if they've been seen by dermatology. And then with the lungs, most patients will also be affected with lung cysts, and then a much smaller proportion will have spontaneous pneumothorax or a lung collapse. Then the next one is hereditary leiomyomatosis and renal cell carcinoma syndrome, which is seen with papillary type 2, also a more rare type of histology. The other features that it has, the main features are uterine leiomyomas, which are just uterine fibroids, and then cutaneous leiomyomas. So you can see in this one too, they've got skin findings that might not be brought to our attention as well. These look a little bit different. They appear kind of like red large patches on the skin. And then the key thing with the fibroids is that individuals who have, women who have these fibroids tend to have earlier onset fibroids that are typically larger in size and more painful than can lead to having hysterectomies earlier in life compared to just an average woman. The next one is hereditary papillary renal cell carcinoma. And the only thing that this is associated with is a type 1 papillary renal cell carcinoma. So that itself is kind of an indicator for a physician to refer because of the rare type of histology. Most of the time, these are also bilateral and multifocal, which is also one of those red flags for hereditary cancer. And individuals might have like hundreds to thousands of these microscopic small tumors. This one's interesting because there's no other features typically seen, none of the skin lesions or other tumors. It's really just associated with the papillary kidney cancer. And then we also talk about a few other syndromes like tuberous sclerosis, because it's associated with kidney cancer as well as renal angiomyolipomas. And then much less often, but we still see individuals in clinic who come back positive, is for Lynch syndrome, for BAP1, because it is has been associated to have a higher risk for kidney cancer, hereditary paraganglioma and pheochromocytoma syndrome, and then P10. But this is kind of a group of syndromes that has as well several other features, and then kidney cancer is kind of lower on the spectrum there. So really when we meet with patients, we take a really deep dive into, you know, when we think about the skin findings, have they seen a dermatologist? Are they aware of any of these changes in their body? And then kind of talk about how some of these other features, if somebody comes back positive, might be, you know, have a minor impact like skin lesions, while others might be more problematic or disruptive. And just what that can look like moving forward if they were to test positive for one of those.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great summary of, you know, the really wide range of conditions that, you know, you're constantly having to think about. And I think it's interesting in this space, among, you know, a couple of others, you're not just necessarily worried about the malignancies, but also, you know, rare benign tumors that can come up with these conditions. And I like that you mentioned some of those skin findings as well. I'm kind of curious, Danica, you know, in general, for a lot of these different conditions, we talk about that 5-10% range of being hereditary. Do you feel like in general with these different kinds of cancers and tumors that you're seeing patients have, do they usually fall within that range, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more? Can you kind of give us a picture of what the yield for pathogenic variants tends to look like with these conditions?
Yeah, definitely. So from my experience in our clinic, it does tend to be lower, I think, in terms of having a pathogenic variant, but I also think that correlates pretty well with what we know about hereditary kidney cancer. We say about maybe 5-8% can be expected to be inherited, compared to maybe higher yields for like ovarian cancer or pheochromocytomas. And I think that also is because many of the syndromes we counsel for and test for are very rare to begin with. So VHL is probably one of the more common ones, expected to be about 1 in 30,000 individuals that might have a VHL mutation. But then the others have maybe just a few hundred or less than 1,000 families that have been identified with that mutation. So I think all that to say, we're testing a lot of people, and many of them are coming back negative. So lower yield, but just kind of casting kind of a wider net so that if there is a mutation out there present in one of these individuals, we can identify it and then better, you know, better assist them.
Yeah, definitely. So kind of just going back a little bit, I know you talked a little bit about VHL, and I think we were all excited a couple of years ago to see that belzutifan was approved by the FDA, you know, treating patients that have a pathogenic variant in VHL. So I'm kind of curious, you know, since that time around 2021, do you feel like the landscape for testing has VHL has changed at all in your personal experience, or not so much still?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yeah, it was super exciting. I'm grateful to have been able to work with Dr. Yonash, who was paramount in the research and just the ability to bring this to access to patients. I think patients themselves have come in expressing a lot of hope and gratitude to potentially have a targeted therapy. And MD Anderson being a center of excellence for VHL, you know, people are really eager to come here and get treatment. So that's been really, really great. I think in terms of testing, our approach remains more or less the same. But I think more individuals are being referred to genetics to kind of rule out VHL. Mm-hmm. So I think providers are just becoming more aware of VHL, the possibility that there could be a treatment implication now, and making sure to inform their patients and send them to us. So I think all in all, it's been really beneficial. And I think the patients have been super excited about that.
Yeah. And just kind of going off of that, I'm curious if, have you noticed if there's been any changes in the guidelines as far as germline testing for VHL, or as far as changes in coverage for testing for VHL now that belzutifan has been approved for treatment?
That's a great question. I haven't really seen many changes yet. Hopefully that's to come. I'd be curious, you know, you mentioned changes in guidelines, if that would be something that changes next, just because it would kind of open the gate for us to be able to test more people if it's found like in the tumor versus just in the germline. So hopefully that's something that they're moving towards.
Definitely. That's kind of the goal, I think, especially since we've seen that with, you know, BRCA testing and really kind of pushing for testing for those, you know, pancreatic cancer, metastatic prostate cancers, if, you know, something similar might happen with VHL testing as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know you mentioned earlier, Janika, kind of as you were introducing yourself and telling us how you got into kidney cancer, that you've also dabbled in other specialty centers and seeing a wide variety of patients with different kinds of cancer conditions. Do you feel like there's anything about specifically counseling about hereditary cancer predispositions that's a little different compared to maybe some of the more common hereditary cancer conditions like HBOC, Lynch syndrome, kind of those things that we might more often see patients coming back positive for?
Yeah, so in a lot of these cases, when we have a positive mutation, we just think about testing individuals' children, which doesn't always happen with a lot of the other hereditary kidney cancer or hereditary cancer syndrome. A lot of the syndromes that we're testing for can cause tumors or cancers in individuals that are in their 20s or even younger, so as early as childhood. So that would be something that's really important for us whenever we're thinking about how to counsel, patients who are usually themselves affected, and then just how they're going to share that information with their at-risk children, who might be at a more delicate age, just being mindful of what that looks like in their family. And then the other thing, which is present in some other indications as well, when we think about like BRCA2, but just thinking about the autosomal recessive impact. So with HLRCC, that does have another consideration when we think about autosomal recessive inheritance of the FH genes. And so those would be kind of the biggest differences or things that we want to make sure to touch on when a family comes back positive that might be a little different than maybe like a Lynch syndrome or HBOC.
So just kind of as we're wrapping up, I'm curious, in your time seeing patients for hereditary renal cancer syndromes, if there's any case or cases that have kind of stuck out to you in particular?
Yeah, so one case that I always think about is a patient who their family doesn't live in Houston, but the patient himself tested positive and then went out of their way to make sure that their sons, who are both adults, made sure to come here to MD Anderson to get tested. And sometimes we don't always get to see that play out. Like, we don't get to see patients after they leave. Their relatives might be, getting testing locally or going through another avenue. But it was really nice to be able to help these individuals understand what they're getting tested for, talk to their children, and just help coordinate testing. And it just becomes kind of a rewarding part of your job, because you become that point of contact, that assistant to providing more like integral information to an individual's health, and then going beyond into their relatives. And I think that kind of circles back to what I was saying in the beginning of why I really wanted to be in this field, is to be able to have that connection with patients. And so that was really meaningful that, we have that in some cases, because sometimes we don't have the opportunity. And then another case comes to mind, more so from a team approach. So I had a patient who was a 66-year-old male with metastatic renal cell carcinoma, and he had had it since, 8 years prior, had had surgery. And then at the time of his surgery, his pathology report showed a loss of SDHB. And even the pathology report actually recommended testing on it, but he never pursued testing at that time. And was being followed because of his metastatic disease for several years at MD Anderson, had had a normal chest, abdominal, and pelvic CT right before meeting with us. But anyways, he opted to pursue testing and came back positive with an SDHB mutation. And I think that case comes to mind a lot, because it was a total of 8 years that he just didn't have any testing done. It looked like he had been encouraged to have genetics several times, but of course, understandably, he had a lot of things going on, and it kind of seemed like it was on the back burner. But just kind of kudos to his team for continuing to remind him that that's something important, and kind of notating that was present. And then ultimately just helpful information for his family. That's a really important test for his family members, particularly his kids, to undergo testing for. And interestingly enough, SDHB is one of the syndromes I didn't go into too much, because it's one of the genes that causes hereditary paraganglioma and pheochromocytoma syndrome, which are the two main things we think about. So it's not really top of radar when we think about kidney cancer. And he had none of the other features associated with that syndrome. So just something really neat that came together. And I think he was very glad that he ultimately had the testing and was able to provide that information to his family members.
Yeah, I think those are really great two examples of, number one, kind of the full circle moment of, you have a patient that comes back positive and actually getting to see in fruition, them talking about cascade testing with their family and having that conversation with them. And then also I love how with your second case, kind of talking about how for some patients that moment might not really be the right time for them to go through germline testing for them personally. They, may have other priorities, but I'm really glad to hear those physicians were really kind of setting those reminders for him, letting him know that this is still an important conversation that he has the option to have. And then also kind of mentioning that he had SDHB, not something that, we would typically expect. So just kind of emphasizing that a lot of times with genetic testing, there can be incidental findings or even, maybe results that we don't typically anticipate coming back positive with panel testing or seeing that these conditions can present in ways that we don't oftentimes see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Danica, thank you so much. I feel like this is a really great conversation, just kind of to give us a quick picture on hereditary renal cell carcinoma syndromes. And thanks so much for just giving us a sneak peek on what your conversations with patients looks like. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for including me. I'm so happy to be a part of this. I appreciate it, and I hope that it's helpful just in sharing the information for anybody who's interested.
Definitely.
Thank you.